This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. So, in this back-to-school time, maybe you're remembering how you never did very well on standardized tests, but you thought you were smart in spite of it. My guest has a theory that might back you up. Howard Gardner developed the theory of multiple intelligences, intelligences which standardized tests don't measure and schools often don't take into account. He's written extensively about intelligence, creativity, genius, and education. His new book, Leading Minds, is about how leaders are created. Gardner is a professor of education and co-director of Project Zero at the Harvard School of Education. In 1981, he was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Award. I asked him for his critique of the conventional school's definition of intelligence.
I think that in most schools, if the term intelligence is used at all, it's used in a one-dimensional sense. That is, just as the language has the term smart and dumb, even people who don't use those words tend to think in terms of one kid as being more able in school or less able in school than another. And this, of course, has a whole theory packed in it. The theory is that there is, in fact, one dimension in which you can array all kids. And it's that theory which I think is totally wrong scientifically and also very dangerous educationally.
You offer a different theory, a theory of multiple intelligences. What are they?
When I wrote about multiple intelligences in the early 1980s, I suggested there were at least seven different kinds of intelligence. Only two of them are focused on in school, linguistic and logical mathematical intelligence. And if you've got that combination, not only are you likely to do well in school, but perhaps more important, you'll be a good test taker, and it'll lead people to think that you're smart. However, once you get outside of a school setting, there are at least five other intelligences. I call them musical, spatial, bodily kinesthetic, and two forms of personal intelligence, one directed toward other people, understanding how they work, how to work with them, and intrapersonal intelligence, which I sometimes think is the most important intelligence, understanding yourself, who you are, what you want, how to achieve it. I mentioned that was the original list. This past year, I've added a new intelligence, which I call the naturalist intelligence, the kind of intelligence that perhaps Charles Darwin had in a special abundance, the ability to recognize and make sense of the world of plants and animals, and building upon that, making any kind of a discrimination within a category, whether it's cars or sneakers or clothing.
Now, there seems something so obvious about everything that you've just said, that there are different kinds of intelligences, and the person who's smart when it comes to books might not be so smart when it comes to a spatial sense or vice versa. What's new about your theory when it seems so obvious, and yet we don't really practice that, I suppose?
Well, I think if I had written a book called Seven Talents, everybody would have nodded, perhaps even nodded to
right.
sleep. It was taking the word intelligence, which in a sense has been come to be owned by testers and people who give IQs and SATs and so on, and saying, hey, wait a second, you guys don't own this. There are other uses of mind, and once you begin to look at people who are sailors or sculptors or artists or clinicians or salespeople or, in fact, entrepreneurs, you'll find that your definition is it's very, very narrow. I often find that people who've made a great deal of money and as entrepreneurs love my theory. And I think one reason is that when they were in school, they didn't do as well in moving notations around as some of the other people. And so they were told they were stupid, even though they saw that they often understood things, patterns, risk-taking, knowing where to put your energies, how to judge people, which is completely missed in a testing kind of context.
Do you have any sense of how much of intelligence is something you're born with and how much of it is something you're taught?
Well, it's almost impossible to avoid posing the question that way, but I think I have to say that almost anybody who is deeply involved in the biological and behavioral sciences now oughtn't to phrase that question in that way, because whatever may be in your genes, from the moment of conception, environmental things begin to affect you. The very fact that you're in a calm intrauterine environment as opposed to one that's very anxious, whether or not the mother is well-fed or ill or taking certain kinds of drugs, begins to affect an individual from the moment of conception. And, of course, once you're born, your experiences every minute have an effect on you. And so it's extremely difficult and perhaps wrong-headed to try to extricate genetic from environmental factors. Having said that, everybody still wants to know, well, Howard, you know, is it the case that the geniuses are born or that they're made? And my own feeling is that clearly people have different potentials in different areas of intelligence, and that's determined by who your parents are. However, whether those potentials are achieved at all depends, first of all, whether relevant activities are available in your society. You could have the potential to be a great chess player, but if the game chess hasn't been invented, of course, you're not going to become a great chess player. So I talk about kids as being at promise or at risk. If they're at promise, it means that given them a modest amount of stimulation, that they will learn quite quickly and probably seem quite intelligent. But even if a child is at risk, even if a child seems to be backward in an area, if we decide as a culture to use a lot of resources to really spend time with something, we will make everybody much better.
You don't like intelligence tests the way they're administered now. IQ tests, feel that way about SATs also?
Yeah, an SAT is basically a souped-up intelligence test, and even though they changed the meaning of SAT, it's now assessment rather than aptitude and changed it a bit, it's still basically a short answer kind of instrument which sees whether you can quickly shift from one linguistic or mathematical frame to another. It doesn't add much predictability to the freshman year score in college, about 2 to 6%. And after the freshman year, it adds no predictability at all. So we might ask, why does everybody still continue to take it, and why are millions and millions of dollars spent every year in coaching and so on? I can say without any fear of contradiction that if tomorrow we eliminated the SAT and we just ask for class ranking and taking a look at the kinds of courses students took, we would do as well in admissions. We would make no fewer errors. And if we instead ask for kids to submit a portfolio of their work, and there was some kind of endorsement they had done it themselves rather than in collaboration, we would get kids and teachers to focus on what's really important, which is exhibiting your knowledge and understanding and not being able to answer a set of decontextualized items, which ought never to be looked at in college. We ought never to have kids sit in college and take 100 items in an hour and then be promoted or not.
Do you think that there should be tests that measure multiple intelligences? Or do you want to just do away with that idea of standardized testing altogether?
The more time I spend on these ideas, and I've now lived with them for about 15 years, the less eager I'm to have people simply develop tests for multiple intelligences, because I think they may turn out to be the disease for which they purport to be the cure. When I talk about finding out about kids' intelligences, I think the best way to do it is to get to know the child well. As a parent, a wonderful thing to do is to take a child to a children's museum and to see what the child is interested in, what he or she interacts with, where they spend time, where they learn something. And that's a nice way of getting view of intelligence, and it's completely non-obtrusive. Frank Oppenheimer, who founded the Exploratorium in San Francisco, said nobody flunks museum, and I think nobody would flunk a test like that. As people get older, they can themselves begin to describe the kinds of things they do well, how they learn, and so on. There are many schools in the country now, probably hundreds, which call themselves multiple intelligences schools, and I only visited a small number of them. But one of the interesting things about those schools is that there's a personalization that goes on in education. Not only do the teachers know more about the kids and make some effort to ask them to do things which can show their intellectual strengths and their problems, but the kids themselves say, you know, I really have difficulty learning about this in a spatial way, but if somebody will either put it on a computer screen so I can look at it and I don't have to do it in my head, or if they will write out an equation or something, it's much, much better for me. Now, again, this sort of stuff just certainly didn't need my theory to be thought about, but giving people some terminology and perhaps a big book written by a professor gives it a certain degree of respectability, and we may as well take advantage of that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Howard Gardner, and his new book is called Leading Minds, An Anatomy of Leadership. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Howard Gardner. He's a professor of education and co-director of Project Zero at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. I think in a way that America has this love-hate relationship with intelligence. On the one hand, people want to be smart. People who are smart are looked up to and admired. Everybody agrees you need intelligence to be a leader and so on. On the other hand, like now there's the expression intellectual elite. You know, that this there's a certain fear, I think, of intellectuals. People put down, back in the 1950s, the expression egghead was a real insult. Have you thought about that much?
I think that you've put it very well. There's a healthy anti-intellectual strand in American history, and I don't think it shows any sign of abating. On the other hand, we also love numbers in our country. We are the country of athletic scores and baseball scores, And it used to be that your IQ was the most important number. People often don't know their IQ now, but they know their SAT scores, and they never forget them. I also think we see the curious ambivalence in the media. On the one hand, everybody, including me, agrees that a certain kind of intellectual ability now is very much at a premium. And so at the same time, we see the country being stratified in that way. We see movies like Forrest Gump and expressions like Dumb and Dumber. And I think people want to say, hey, there's a place for us. It just can't be the case that there's a single intellectual elite.
Your new book is called Leading Minds, An Anatomy of Leadership, and it's a study of the traits that certain leaders have had, leaders including Margaret Thatcher, Eleanor Roosevelt, Martin Luther King, Margaret Mead, Pope John, Gandhi. What made you decide to look at leadership?
I had written a book about creativity in which I looked at individuals who had enormous influence in this century because of the kind of work that they had done, people like Picasso, and Sigmund Freud, and Martha Graham, T.S. Eliot. One of the individuals whom I looked at was Gandhi. And in some ways, Gandhi was very much like other creative individuals, but he was also different in the way that he affected other people. And I began to ponder, why is somebody who is known as a leader, a la Gandhi, a different kind of person than someone who is called creative, like a Picasso or a Martha Graham? And one of those flashes that occasionally happens to somebody who lives mostly in the world of ideas, I said to myself that the unschooled mind is part of the solution to what leadership is all about. And what I meant by that is that if you are a creator working in a domain, let's say like T.S. Eliot writing poetry, you don't have to address everybody. You basically address the people who are interested in poetry, and you can assume they have a sophisticated understanding of language and poetry. If, however, you are the leader of any kind of a heterogeneous group, like the leader of a nation or the leader of a large organization, you've got to be able to talk across various kinds of minds, which means you have to be able to deal with an unschooled mind, a mind that's not an expert.
Did you find that the leaders you wrote about shared anything in common?
Perhaps the most surprising thing to me was their willingness when they were young to challenge authority. These were often individuals who came from relatively meager backgrounds, didn't have a lot of leaders around, and yet they developed a kind of self-confidence that when they were in a room or in a situation with somebody who was an authority, they would challenge those individuals. There's one other thing, too, about the leaders that intrigued me from the point of view of my theory of multiple intelligences, and that is that leaders are storytellers. They tell stories about the groups with which they're involved, what I call identity stories. And that means that leaders have to be very good with language. Now, not all leaders are born being good with language, obviously, but what they then do, people like Churchill, is they work tirelessly to make themselves fluent speakers and also sometimes fluent writers. And it's the combination of being a good storyteller and having an understanding of other people, what I call personal intelligence, which makes a person a leader. You'll notice this is very different from what it takes to do well in school. In school, your logical mathematical ability is very important. That seemed never to turn up in my studies of leadership.
Howard Gardner is my guest. He's written extensively about intelligence, creativity. His new book is on leadership. It's called Leading Minds. You know, earlier you said to me that everybody who takes the SATs remembers their scores for the rest of their lives. Do you remember yours?
I actually took them more than once, and I was a very, very good test taker.
Uh-huh. So what did you get on the SATs, and what impact did that number have on you?
Okay, you're pushing me, Terry.
Yes.
I think if you went back and looked at the record, you'd see I got about 740 in the verbal and 770 in the math. And an achievement
test. Well,
that's
great. Test, I mean, 800, I think, was like top score, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so that's pretty darn good. So did you feel like I'm smart when you got those numbers back?
I was what we call a big fish in a little pond. I grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and went to a small school there. And I guess the honest answer is that everybody always told me I was smart, so I believed that. I think I would have been shocked if I had gotten low scores in the tests. And even when I went off to college and got to be a fish in a much bigger pond, I remained a very good test taker. And it's not that I ever felt that I was phony, but I knew very well that I had a certain kind of skill which was a hell of a lot more useful for getting high grades than it was going to be for other kinds of things in the real world. Maybe I stayed a professor for that reason.
Now, how important was getting good grades in your family?
My family were immigrants from Germany, from Nazi Germany. They did not have a formal education themselves, but I think the implicit message was that you should be a good student, you should work hard. And since it didn't come particularly difficult to me, I had no particular problems with that. As I've grown older and developed my own sense of education, I think probably my grades and doing well in the competition was excessively important for me. And it was only when I went to graduate school that I realized that grades were completely unimportant, and that I needed to decide what I wanted to understand and why. And I think since then, I've let my own values be determinant. However, I wish that the mentality that I developed in graduate school would have been developed earlier. I think it would have been healthier.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Howard Gardner is co-director of Project Zero at the Harvard School of Education. His new book is Leading Minds, An Anatomy of Leadership. This is Fresh Air.